the two horses and Shasta, they're in slavery. It's understandable why they want to get away. But Erebus, like, what more? She has everything she could possibly want. She's a princess. It's not enough.
It's not enough.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world.
And can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts.
From NarniaWeb.com.
Where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis.
And keep a watchful eye.
On the latest Narnia movie news,
this is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian.
I'm Glenn Puddle.
No longer hosting.
No longer hosting. It was nice while it lasted. At least I hope it was.
You know, you actually did a good job.
That was like a month ago, though, because this is coming out, I think, June 5th. And we just moments ago finished recording the episode about Marcus and McVeely's comments.
Hence why we don't have comments about all you guys. So it's not like we're ignoring you. We just don't have an ability to just look into the future. So on the last, well, not the last episode, but the episode before, we had... Really, it was a great discussion on one of my favorite scenes of dialogue in The Horse and His Boy with the Tisrock.
Mm-hmm.
May he not live forever.
Boom!
We had Lacerilene and Erebus listening in on the Tisrock's evil plans. And really right now, we go minutes later in the next chapter. Erebus is still trying to escape. And really, I kind of picture in my mind, in my imagination, it's almost like one of those dark nighttime scenes, almost like with Prince Caspian and Dr. Cornelius, where he's trying to escape, like almost that kind of hurried, hushed kind of feeling at nighttime. I'm wondering, is this Erebus's real turning point? Because we see little bits where she starts to appreciate Shasta more, or she comes to appreciate Bree maybe more than she might initially. Is this two chapters or this moment here, is this the real turning point for Erebus where she's just... She knows that this was not the life for her at all.
Interesting. And I don't think this is the moment where she says, oh, wow, this life isn't for me. I think she never showed any signs of at all. But I almost wonder if it's the – she never showed any signs of really being attracted to this life, and her kind of eye rolling and sort of disgust towards Lacerilene's behavior only reinforces that. Yeah, so I think it's just overhearing the conversation between the Tisrock and the prince and Ahashta only just furthers her resolve that, no, this is not for me. I will say it might be a turning point for how she views herself in a way. And how she, I think this might be where, and again, humility is a big theme in the book, where she starts, it really humbles her, the fact that these people that she looks up to, that being, you know, Prince Rabadash and the Tisrock, are, wow, look at how much they don't care about others. Look at how they view others. Look at how they puff themselves up as being so amazing, and of other life being having so little value. And she's had a chance now to get to know Shasta, a little peasant boy, and realize he's a real. She doesn't necessarily like him, but he's a real person.
She even says, "Yes, and I'd sooner be killed than married to Ahashta." And you almost get the feeling with that coming from Erebus, she means it. That it's not hyperbole.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you get the feeling, because other people say, I'd rather die. But for her, you get the feeling that she actually would rather die.
She was
ready to commit suicide. So maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not it's a huge turning point for her. But for me, it seems like it's certainly her resolve is steeled now.
I think it's a turning point in that this might, I didn't think of that until just now. I think that this might be the moment where Erebus is really starts to be humbled. Because certainly she's, and when she walks through Teshban, she's like, oh, I should be walking in with slaves before me and soldiers behind and all that. And so in her mind, it's still, oh, it's different for you, Shasta. And now I think she's realizing this thing, this kind of, these people who are above her, the Tisrock and the prince. And when she sees what her country really is and how they talk about people like Shasta as if they're nothing. And, oh, yeah, you know, whatever, we'll just kill... Just kill them at a whim, basically, because we have some other political desire or sexual desire, whatever the prince wants. And and now she's went, wow, this thing that I was so proud of, look at what it really is. Now that I get to, you know, now that she's hidden behind a couch and actually overheard them when they don't know that, like, wow, here's actually what's behind that facade. So I think this is the beginning of Erebus really being humbled and seeing Shasta differently.
Well, and it's interesting where you see... you almost get more of a glimpse into her character when you look at how she treats Lacerilene. And of course, Lacerilene does, like you said earlier, she does kind of get a bad rap.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she is a friend. She does watch out for her. She does, you could say, save her life. And, so it's easy for her to get a bad rap. But it's interesting seeing how they say goodbye and how, and Aravis's attitude towards her, because, and I was even thinking, you know, what does this really say about her? Just her attitude. Cause it's not even a very combative attitude at all. It is, like you said, it's a very humble attitude.
Yeah. I wonder how much she, like when she tells Lacerilene, I think your house is lovely too. I'm sure you'll have a lovely life though. Wouldn't suit me. I wonder how sincere is that? Is she really like, okay with the fact that, well, this is the life for Lacerilene, but it's not for me. I wonder if Erebus, I'd almost feel pity for Lacerilene. Like, really? These are the people who, look at what your country really is.
Right. I think she is kind of serious. Because first of all, Lacerilene wants to stay there. And I don't think that she's saying in a, kind of on a, cultural relativity sort of way, well, you know, that's for you and this is for me. I think that she's saying, you know, this is what you want, I could never be happy here, but I sincerely hope that you can be happy. Yeah. I think she's just genuinely wishing her well, because why would she wish her to be miserable? I mean, obviously
you can think
about this with, you know, maybe friends of yours where you think, oh, this is a horrible path you're on. And I've thought about this with friends of mine or people I know, this is a horrible path you're on. And that's certainly not the life for me. But, you know, I truly do hope that you can find happiness in what you're pursuing.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
But it is an interesting point for Erebus, because from this point, you kind of get the feeling that she's not looking back at all.
Yeah.
She has no questions. There's not a part of her that's thinking, oh, you know, if only I were, you know, up there, you know.
Absolutely.
Like she was when she arrived at Tashban.
Absolutely. That kind of makes sense with you know, Bree and Huynh and Shasta, when you look at the lives they have. Of course, the horses are in slavery and Shasta's in semi-slavery. But Erebus, you know, we've seen the life that she could have had, and she's a princess, you know? And yet we see that, no, she has no temptation. That holds no pull on her at all. She knows that there is so much more to life than this. I have to get out of here.
And it's interesting how her life, it's easy to reduce her life choices down to, well, is she going to just marry Ahashta? Because that's kind of how her crisis starts out. Well, am I going to be in this forced marriage or not? But her path that she can choose is really so much broader than that. And it's interesting how I often think about this line of Aslan's just in daily life, where he says in The Magician's Nephew, he says, people always get what they want. They don't always like it. And I've had discussions with friends where I'm all for individual liberty and freedom and stuff. You know, hey, freedom's great. But, you know, it's interesting how so many miserable lives people end up in are out of their own choices.
Uh-huh.
And you really can choose so much that just even though you chose it, you end up being miserable. And I think she sees that.
And one of the themes I think of throughout the series is throughout the Chronicles of Narnia, is a desire for something beyond your world. In the case of, again, you have the two horses and Shasta, they're in slavery. It's understandable why they want to get away. But Erebus, like, what she has everything she could possibly want. She's a princess. It's not enough.
It's not enough.
And a lot of times people get what they think they want, mm-hmm. and then they get there, and they're still not happy.
Yeah.
And then what do you do after that? It's almost easier to know what you be living a harder life and have less, because then you have that thing to strive for. The problem is, what happens when you get it and it's still not enough? And of course, C.S. Lewis said, if I find in myself a desire, I'm paraphrasing, but basically said, if you find in myself a desire that can't be satisfied on earth, the only explanation is I was made for another world.
Yeah.
And that's what Lewis believed.
The fish doesn't know that he's in water because he's never known anything else.
Exactly.
And I even think about, I saw this video one time and it all stuck with me. I don't know who it was, but he is a very successful NFL player. Led his team to the Super Bowl.
Tom Brady, yeah.
Tom Brady, the quarterback of the New England Patriots, has already won 3 Super Bowls, an accomplishment that ranks him with some of the best quarterbacks ever to play the game.
In addition to his success on the field and his sex appeal off it, there is also the $60 million 10-year contract to play with the Patriots.
I mean, I'm making more money now than I ever thought I could ever make.
But with all that money, fame, and career accomplishments, we were surprised to hear this from him.
Why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life is me. I thank God. It's got to be more than this.
What's the answer?
I wish I knew.
Yeah, because he's saying there's got to be more than life than this. It's just not enough. But anyway, so it's that desire that leads our characters across the desert. And of course, our characters are reunited. And you know, we kind of have this moment where, and this would be kind of a hard moment in a moment in the movie, but to figure out the timelines on how you're going to tell everyone's story. And I guess you could just have everyone meeting together at once. But our characters, Wynn and Bree and Shasta and Erebus, are reunited, and across the desert they go.
Mm-hmm. I've got the Lawrence of Arabia music in my head at this point. I think you said Gladiator was kind of your theme. For
kind of right boy. Now, unfortunately, I have the opening to the movie Aladdin.
Great.
Arabian Nights. Sorry.
Oh, gosh.
So...
Anyway, I was going to do Lawrence of Arabia. I guess I won't.
I wish I had Lawrence of Arabia in my head. Anyway,
very similar scene in Lawrence of Arabia where they're having to cross the desert, and it's my favorite scene in the movie. I always think of that when I think of the horse and his
bride. Oh, where he says, "I'll drink whenever you drink." That scene,
or it's I can't remember exactly. Just the whole thing of when they're having to cross the desert. They're going to Aqaba, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Aqaba's right there. It's just a matter of going, and the way they do the montage, and the way they do the psychological aspects of feeling like you're in the middle of nowhere, and that's such a great movie. Yeah, that's always been kind of my visual reference for The Horse and His Boy.
And I love the practical aspect of how. Of course, my dad read this to me as a little kid. I've always thought, man, if I'm in the desert, I hope I'm not barefoot because I'm going to be like Shasta. And I thought about this, that little moment where he steps down and he can't walk anymore. And Bree has to carry him. And Bree said, I should have thought of this, but I didn't. I think about the little practical aspects.
And initially, of course, it's only reinforced by the fact that they're so happy to have left Tashban. But initially, it's very pleasant and it's cool. And even when the sun comes up, initially, it's really nice. And then slowly... It's like in Lawrence of Arabia, it's called the anvil. They call the anvil like the hottest part of the desert where there's the most danger, and they try to cross that part by nighttime. It's sort of they're getting closer and closer to that anvil of the desert, and there's an impending sense of doom. And you look around 360 degrees, and you're just in the middle of nowhere. And Lewis, there's no sense of is this ever going to end? And after a while, they start to feel like they're not moving at all. And Lewis takes the time to get us into that headspace of what's it like to almost have no sense of time and no sense of when this is going to end. It kind of reminds me of the sunless sea in The Silver Chair.
I'll tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of a road trip I took with my in-laws across the Mojave Desert. And
in-laws, huh?
Well, I actually love my in-laws. I have a great relationship with them. It wasn't the in-laws thing. It was the desert thing. And man, I'm driving in this giant Ford Transit, which gets surprisingly good gas mileage, across the desert. And I'm thinking, if this thing breaks down, it's going to be one miserable day. And the only reason that we're not all going to die is because this is a major highway. I mean, and you do feel vulnerable. I mean, you're going across and I'm thinking, we don't have a whole lot of extra water. If the vehicle broke down and this were not a major highway with cars passing all the time, we would die. It is a vulnerable feeling. And, you know, we were able to do it, and it still took several hours, even with modern transportation, but it is a vulnerable feeling when you're out in the middle of a bleak desert like that.
And I'm one of those people that's always, always thirsty. So I would immediately be going, oh, dear. It's funny what it brought to you, kind of a specific event related to a desert for you. For me, it kind of brought to mind something a little more of an abstract connection, but it brought to mind after I got my bachelor's degree, it took me a couple years to find
the desert of unemployment. Sorry.
Yes. You know where I'm going with this, but It took me a couple of years to find a real job.
Oh, you were going there. I'm sorry. I was not trying to be rude.
You want to go and finish the story for me?
No, I wasn't trying to steal your thunder. Please continue.
It was a couple of years before I found a real job. At the time, that felt like really, really long. At the time, because there was no sense of when is this unemployment phase of my life? I mean, I got not unemployment. I got little jobs to get by. But when am I going to get a real job? At the time, that felt miserably long because there was I had no context because I had no sense of when is this going to end? And maybe I have to. I remember I was kind of venting to my dad about it on the phone one time, and eventually he said, "Well, here's a few things you can try, and if that doesn't work, maybe you have to try something else." And I was just silent because I just had never considered that. Like, I can't. All I know how to do is produce videos. That's all I know how to do. No, I've got to keep looking. But anyway, I look back on that now, and I go, oh, it was just a couple of years, and I got some odd jobs, and some of it was even decent experience, whatever. But at the time, it felt so long and so hopeless. And that's kind of what the idea of being in a desert brought to mind to me, of looking around 360 degrees and you don't know when the desert's going to end exactly. And that just seems to tie right into Horse and His Boy, because of course at the moment Shasta is starting to feel like the most unfortunate boy in the whole world. All these things that have happened to him, but he's going to, spoiler alert, going to meet Aslan, and Aslan will say, actually, I was there all along, and I've been guiding kind of subtly, taking care of you every step of the way. And now Shasta will look back at his life on the other side and go, wow, actually, I'm extremely fortunate. Everything seemed random, and I seemed like I was so unlucky, but actually it was all part of a larger plan. So just the way something feels, the way life feels in context versus the way it's if you're in one of those deserts, I just have to remind myself that, hey, one of these days I may look back on this time and look at it very differently.
Well, again, please forgive me for stealing your thunder. I was not trying to give away the punchline. I was trying to make a joke. I didn't realize I was making a joke about a proverbial desert in your life. So I'm sorry about that.
Well, okay. You're forgiven.
I do know the job hunt frustration. So, but yeah, I mean, I don't know if you could have a truly great story without some kind of desert experience in there. Mm-hmm. Seems to be a theme within a lot of great stories.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the desert, like our efforts to find permanent jobs, the desert ends for Shasta Bree et al.
Uh-huh.
and so they find the valley, find the little, it starts basically as a little trickle and a creek, and then it ends up being an actual river.
Uh-huh.
And
that's so satisfying. There's a lot of scenes and stories where people have been thirsty or hungry for a while and they finally get their food and water. And that's always so satisfying.
Yeah. Can I just say that? Speaking of which, I just finished my glass of water. So, wait, oh, there's more. Okay, now I'm thirsty.
Not as satisfying for me, but I'll take your word for it.
No, not as satisfying. But and so they continue. And then something interesting kind of happens in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as a reader, you think, oh man, the poor characters, they're in the desert. Oh, I'm so happy for them. You're going through this kind of period of elation. Oh, I know that feeling must be like when you're so thirsty and you finally get water. And then you kind of get this frustration with the characters as they get lazy.
And they actually take a nap when they have to hurry up and warn Arkenland that Prince Rabadash is on the way. What's interesting is I feel the sense of urgency, of course. But I feel like I relate to them. I almost feel.
Yeah, you can kind of get it.
I totally get it. Oh my gosh, they're obviously so tired, and I'm so in their headspace right now that I relate to just drifting off to sleep. And I'm actually not that frustrated with them. And I think it speaks to what a good job Lewis does, really getting us into the headspace of these characters. The fact that at least for me, that I'm not screaming at the page, go, no, get up. But just like with Shasta, the fact that Shasta doesn't reveal himself to Queen Susan and King Edmund and the other Narnians. I actually get it. You know, I don't, not, yeah. I'm not screaming at the page.
Maybe it's not fair for me to say they all get lazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think when the whole world's on the line, I mean, it definitely, Lewis kind of portrays it as laziness later. He talks about how Bree was used to having a rider on his back, and Bree was used to having someone with those spurs or the whip or to keep going, but now he doesn't. And so what happens when you've And Lewis basically says, you know, people who have lived like that for a while, they have a hard time motivating themselves. I kind of relate to that, by the way. Again, going back to my job situation, I used to be in a job where that without, you know, let's just say that whip was always right behind me. And now I'm in a job where it's a better job. I like it a lot more, but that whip isn't necessarily always right behind me. I have to show a lot of initiative and it's hard.
Yeah, that's true. I can relate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because, of course, you know, Wynn tries to say, well, you know, I think we could go on. I mean, after all, don't humans push us harder when they're riding on our backs and they have spurs and things. Uh-huh. And of course, Bree says, I think, ma'am, said Bree very crushingly, mm-hmm. that I know a little more about campaigns and forced marches and what a horse can stand than you do, which is incredibly rude.
Pride and humility, big theme in this story. And of course, Bree's totally, Gwyn is totally right here. And maybe yeah, Bree does completely. Know more about that, but Gwyn has, it's really Gwyn's character here that she is, maybe she's actually more equipped than Bree to deal, make this decision right now because she doesn't have, she has the reliant motivation. Yeah, she does. She actually has more motivation than Bree, and that's more important. Mm-hmm. We don't need the experience of forced marches and such right now. We need emotional right. support right now, and that's kind of what Gwyn. No, come on, we got to keep going. We need the encouragement. So Gwyn is actually more Gwyn's more of the hero here, or at least she tried to be the hero. But then she was put down.
And Bree is certain. I mean, Bree is certainly not the hero right here.
Bree is the one who's really all set up to be the hero of the story at the beginning.
He is.
And then he's totally not. In fact,
completely.
He's really the one here, I think, more than the others, who I feel like is kind of, because he's a big war horse.
He's the very alpha. Yeah.
Yeah. And he.
Yeah,
so
we're going this way.
Right. So it's really Bree is the one who, and he's the one who, you know, is the biggest coward when it comes to lions. So really, Bree was all set up to be the hero of the book. And it's really, wow, in spite of Bree, they managed to save Narnia.
Yeah.
It's kind of what happened.
Yeah, that's interesting. In spite of Bree, they saved Narnia.
But you know, humility and pride in the reversal. That's what the title refers to. The fact that it starts out as the horse and his boy.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end, it's more like the boy and his horse. And that it's Bree actually gets humbled and Shasta goes on to save Narnia.
Yeah.
And Erebus, yeah. Interesting that Erebus says that she ought to have known better. When Erebus, I think Erebus is the first to wake up and she's the one who goes, oh, I ought to have known better. Of course, I can't expect someone like Shasta to know, and the two horses right. have been riding for so long, but I should have known better, and
to an extent she's right.
Yeah, and I don't see that as pride. I see that as her taking responsibility.
Yeah, no, she's owning it. Maybe if just to herself.
Yeah,
you're right. I mean, she should, and that's why it's kind of interesting because you know, Erebus is. I mean, and she's almost my favorite character in this story. I think I've said she uh-huh. is. And I love the character of Erebus, and she's in some ways would be certainly in almost like a modern storytelling setting. She would be almost be the hero. She would be the heroine of the story.
Uh-huh.
The horse and his girl, but or the girl and her horse.
Yeah, with Gwyn and Erebus, it's the girl and her horse, and then it becomes a little more like the horse and her girl by the end. If someone wants to write the spinoff story.
No, please don't.
There you go.
I saw the lally wig thing with Puddleglum's
niece.
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't remember what that was called.
Let's not go there again.
Yeah, no.
A giant surprise.
It was a desert. It was a desert. But we
it was
made
a desert
out.
For Narnia fans. It did not last very long, fortunately.
Yeah. And we kind of leave with that. It's kind of a cliffhanger almost at the end because it's like, oh.
Yep.
And with that, let's go ahead and we will go to our Voices of Narnia Web and our C.S. Lewis Minute.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hey, Narnia Web. My name is Jenna Lynn, also known as Fire Fairy, and I'm from Utah. My first memory of Narnia was in elementary school when a theater company came and performed The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe for us with only two actors. I think I had been familiar with the story by then, but that was the first time that it really struck a chord with me. I loved the story, and I loved how they managed to perform it with only two actors, and it just fed off a chain of events and helped me become such a big fan. And I joined Narnia Web in 2009, in my first year of college. But my love of Narnia came full circle when my son was born 4 years ago, and he had some problems with his oxygen levels dropping, and he had to stay in the NICU for 5 days. And so since I had nothing else to do other than stay at the hospital all day, I went home and I grabbed two books. I grabbed Howl's Moving Castle, and I grabbed my pocket copy of The Magician's Nephew, because I wasn't sure what I was going to read. And I got to back to the NICU and sat down next to my baby boy, and I decided to read The Magician's Nephew. And after that, even after he was discharged, I just kept reading to him. And I read to him all 7 books within his first year. My favorite character has always been Lucy. I've always loved how she stays faithful even when nobody believes her. And it really resonated with me as someone who's always been a little more religious than my peers. And Lucy has always been a character that I could aspire to become like. And my favorite scene is the creation of Narnia in The Magician's Nephew. I just love the magic and the fantastic imagery and the way Lewis paints the scene, and I can almost hear the music in my head of Aslan singing the creation. And I think that scene is what influenced me as a writer and helped me develop my own personal writing style. So that is why Narnia is so special to me.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. What book of the Bible did C.S. Lewis read more than any other? If you're familiar with most of the works of Lewis, it will come as no surprise that he enjoyed the Book of Psalms in the Bible. It was the one he read most often. In fact, his only work devoted to a biblical book was on the Psalms. With a title like Reflections on the Psalms, it's clear the volume is not intended to be an exhaustive study. Those who are used to his reasoned arguments in defense of Christianity could be surprised at the content. Lewis opens his book with the sentence, quote, "This is not a work of scholarship." He also notes he writes as one amateur to another on the subject, stressing his main purpose is to present his own reflections for others to consider. Thus, his aim is helping a person better enjoy the Psalms. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
All right, let's jump in Narnia Weber. Rillian, are you ready? just take your medicine, man. And I mean, I'm going to do it even if you're not ready, so it doesn't matter.
All right, let's do this.
Okay, so this is something I came across recently because, as you know, I'm developing, along with the Rose Tree Dryad's help, developing a lot of new content and new Narnia resources for Narnia Web. And one of those things is information about the book dedications. So your question is, which Chronicles of Narnia book is the only one to not include a dedication?
Oh, that's a good question. Okay.
In other words, Lewis dedicated 6 of the books to certain people, but one of them was not dedicated to anyone. Which one was it?
That's a good one. It's not it's the Wardrobe. That was dedicated to Lucy Barfield. I'm trying to see. I think...
can give you a hint if you want it.
I'm trying to think. Well, one of them was dedicated to Douglas and David Gresham. I don't think it's going to be the magician's nephew. I don't remember a dedication for Prince Caspian or the last battle.
But you do for the other ones?
Well, it's more of a feeling because it's not like I can just rattle them off. I'm going to have to blow Queen Susan's horn.
Okay, so your hint is... So I got this information from an article on thelionscall.com, and the author speculated the book might have been left without without a dedication because of the dark tone.
Well, I'm going to... And my first instinct was I couldn't remember... The last battle was one I couldn't remember a dedication for at all. I just can't remember one being there. So I'm going to guess the last battle...
So you're saying The Last Battle is the only Narnia book to not receive a dedication. Is that your final answer?
I'm going
to
go with The Last Battle.
The Last Battle is correct. The only Narnia book to not get a dedication, interestingly. For the others, really quick.
I'm curious.
Yes,
go ahead.
Yeah, so The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, of course, was to Lucy Barfield, who was the daughter of Owen Barfield. And
one of the Inklings.
That's where Lewis famously has that letter at the beginning. He says, I wrote this story for you, and then he says the whole thing about someday you'll be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. That's the only one that has like a little note at the beginning. Prince Caspian was dedicated to Mary Claire Havard. Is that how you say it? Mary Claire Havard? Don't know how
Maybe.
To pronounce that.
Sure. Yes, that is correct.
Uh-huh. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader was to Geoffrey Barfield. The Silver Chair to Nicholas Hardy. The Horse and His Boy to David and Douglas Gresham. And then finally, The Magician's Nephew to the Kilmer family. And Last Battle did not get anything. But we're working on a page right now with information about C.S. Lewis and quotes from him and stuff, a handy resource to have on Narnia Web. And there'll be more information in there about who all these people were and why Lewis dedicated books to them and stuff like that. Our next episode is going to be our season finale, and then we'll finish the Horse and His Boy commentary series in the fall. And the next episode, the topic will be based on a thread started by Charlotte in the Talking Beast Facebook group, basically asking if Lewis had written an eighth Narnia book, what would you have wanted it to be about? And we're going to be discussing that and going through some of your comments, and then we'll be done for this season and pick up in the fall, and we'll see if we have... movie news to discuss or not. They're talking about filming this winter, but we'll see how that goes.
See.
All right, so we'll be back in a couple weeks with our season finale. Rillian, why don't you take it away with the outro?
All right, here we go. I should do it sometime with a dwarfish accent, which would be the same as a Scottish accent. Okay, which someone please, you know, maybe Jens or someone can tell me, why are dwarves always Scottish? I don't know.
Well, sorry to spring it on you. Like, if you want to think about it for a moment, we can stop recording.
No, no, no. We'll do it.
Give
it
to me.
Okay,
give it to me. All right. This is raw. This is real.
You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniaWeb.com, Rillian@NarniaWeb.com, or Glumpuddle@NarniaWeb.com. Special thanks to IJ Aiken, Ryadian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silver Chair movie, visit NarniaWeb.com. A new episode of Talking Beasts is posted every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.
For that one, I'm going to buy you a pint.
Many thanks. Cheers.